Good morning, and welcome to this month's installment of the Buddhist Chaplaincy Speaker Series here at the Sati Center. Today, I'm so delighted to welcome Kirsten DiLeo, who is joining us from Ireland. This is a real treat. Kirsten is a meditation teacher, an end-of-life care giver, and a spiritual care trainer. Based on her experience supporting dying people, she wrote the award-winning book Present Through the End, A Caring Companion's Guide for Accompanying the Dying. Kirsten helped to pioneer one of the first training programs in contemplative end-of-life care called Authentic Presence. She was a founding member of the Harvard Buddhist Ministry Working Group, and currently supports the European Buddhist Union Chaplaincy Network. Kirsten trained in the Hakomi mindfulness-based somatic approach to psychotherapy and has been immersed in Tibetan Buddhist study for over 25 years, including a 3-year retreat. Kirsten also lived many years in San Francisco and served at the Zen Hospice and Maitri. Kirsten now lives in Ireland, and she is at the Dzogchen Beara Buddhist Meditation Center, where she teaches and serves as a Buddhist chaplain at its spiritual care center. And the center is located on a beautiful spot that overlooks the Atlantic Ocean, and it offers support to people who are bereaved, ill, or facing the end of their lives. So, Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I welcome you, and I will pass it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa, and everybody at the Sati Center. Thank you for having me. This feels like coming home. I lived over 20 years in San Francisco. My heart is still there. Good to see everyone. And yes, afternoon here. You're probably still having your morning coffee. I have my afternoon tea. So I thought for this hour, to spend some time to reflect on the nature of spiritual care and end-of-life care, right at the threshold of life and death, and then also open up the space for you, for your observations, stories, questions, your insights, and your own learnings. Because I know we all carry something and have experiences with that topic. And at least most of us, I would assume, no? So we have some time with that, and also would like to share a little bit about the work here in Ireland. We have a spiritual care center, which is an integral part of our Buddhist center, and is the one is the Only the second spiritual care center in Europe, so it's quite a pioneering thing. Good. So I hope that sounds okay. Yeah, that's okay. Good. So with spiritual care at the threshold of life and death, it really takes our whole being, our whole being, to be there, to really be there, be present. And it's not easy. At the same time, it's also incredibly rewarding and beautiful. So it's we really kind of see the loss and grief and the suffering and the deepest pain possible. At the same time, also the beauty of what it means to be human. And I started the work in Germany, and then moved to San Francisco to work at the Zen Center, the Zen Hospice at the time. And there were volunteers sent to Laguna Honda. Maybe some of you know Laguna Honda Hospital. It's used to be one of the largest nursing facilities in the U.S. with still open wards. The hospice ward had 28 beds in one room, only divided by curtains. So men on right at the entrance, and the women on the furthest side of the room, in the back. And the curtains around the bed were not even going down all the way, but only halfway. So when I started there, I remember, when you go, I think the station is called Forest Hill. When you go up, I walked up the steps, and there's a long way up the hill to the hospital. And I thought, wow, I'm not sure if I can do this. I'm not sure if I can do this. 28 people from across San Francisco. I was just I just had freshly arrived from Europe, so it was also a culture shock. And so, but when I walked through the door, there was a big open swing, kind of door swung open, and what I really found, and still stays with me to this day, and that's why I love to tell the stories, the amount of love. Really, the amount of love I met and I was embraced with, because what happened, that there were 28 people dying in different phases of their dying from all over the city, homeless people, middle class, all colors, backgrounds, social backgrounds. But what was beautiful to see, the community they formed as human beings, with conflicts, of course, and the normalcy of it. And the staff, and particularly CNAs, did a fantastic job just to be, to be present. And they taught me. I think the most I've learned from them, to really be present. And so what I've learned, that the practice of spiritual care, of caring for somebody with a spiritual awareness, is really a practice of love. It's really a practice of love, of profound love. Because, when we meet the depths of suffering, it's, sometimes there is nothing we can say or do. Yeah. Words cannot reach it. And so only just being quietly, silently present and really sending our love to the person, knowing I cannot change the situation. So in one way, nothing has had prepared me for this. I had started hospice work and also spiritual care work in Germany. But what I discovered is a practice of love, that spiritual care is in essence a practice of love. And it's about the relievance of suffering and being with our human brokenness. So that's really a profound experience. And with a practice of love, and especially for Buddhists, I find it very inspiring that this whole the notion of being a spiritual friend, and also the idea of accompaniment. So we are walking alongside somebody. So it's a deeply human experience. And so it's nothing that, because I struggle with the word caregiving or providing, offering care, and even sometimes with the word service, because it's always the notion I offer something, I offer something. And but what I've learned with this practice of love is it's really about just being there as to another fellow human being, and how they make sense of their own journey, of their experience, and the beauty of have that as a shared experience. And yeah, so that has been my experience, the practice of love, and how much also meditation helped me, or is still helping me, to learn to be present. And as I said, and sometimes, with being at the bedside, and at the bedside is a metaphor. At the bedside could be, with a family member in a meeting, but with other people, and it's not always, know when somebody gets a diagnosis, and then the whole journey is, with this deep wish of relievance of suffering, I cannot always, or there's not always possible So even, and as a spiritual caregiver or a spiritual carer to work as a team, I've been in situation where it was really hard, We didn't know how to address somebody's suffering. But then just to, as a team to see, well, what we offer our presence this is what is really healing. And I remember at the Zen Hospice in San Francisco, the old Victorian house, maybe some of you remember or have been there. I was with a Japanese lady, and she was, she had never left her house for before she moved to hospice. She was at home for 15 years, hadn't left her house, was really scared of the world, really closed in. And there she was, completely exposed, people going in and out of her room. The interesting fact, however, was she had her door always half ajar, never closed, which was, I thought was interesting. So I just sat with her, and she often didn't say anything. I just sat with her, and I just always politely asked if that's okay to sit with her, and she said yes. And that was, and she bowed, I bowed, and then I left. So that was the whole interaction for some time. And then one time she asked me to sit really on her bed, on her mattress, and said, and then she took my hand and said, why do you do that, Kirsten? Why do you do this? Why is everybody so kind? Yeah, that hasn't, so I could tell that has never been her experience her entire life, that people are just kind, really kind. And she said, that's, yeah, really, it warmed her heart, and we and then allowed her to allow us to be with her. No, this is through kindness, to really kindness. And the spiritual care as a practice is also a practice of leaning, really leaning into our own mortality, isn't it? Our own impermanence, our own. Yeah, making friends with our own dying and death, coming to terms with our own losses and aging, and so it's there's one teaching from a Tibetan Buddhist master. I try to practice this as much as I can, and he said to his students, he was about to leave on a long journey, and he said to his, and one of his students said, "Oh, teacher, teacher, don't leave us, or at least give us your heart advice. Really, give us your heart advice." And his heart advice were three lines. He said, "I'm impermanent. You are impermanent. I'm impermanent. You are impermanent. I'm impermanent. You are impermanent. Practice this." That was his teaching. Yeah. And I think that's our teaching. This is our practice in end of life care. It's so easy when we go in, and I catch myself to this day that I think I'm bulletproof, I'm bulletproof. The other person is dying. I'm safe. But that's not true. Yeah, that's really not true. So to really allow death to touch us, to lean into it, to make friends with it as much as possible, can really, really help us to be there, to be present, and to also to relax and feel a bit more at ease, a bit more comfortable. Yeah. Does it make sense? Yeah. Oh, look at you. Yeah, good. So it's a practice of love. It's a practice of making friends with ourselves. With ourselves and with coming to terms with dying and our mortality. And spiritual care is it's a very profound practice, a very profound practice of recognizing the other person's wholeness, recognizing their capacity, their deepest capacity to be well, to heal, even in death. Because what I've seen over the years, that some people really grow inward, you know, the outer world is kind of shrinking, and they become less and less limited, but the inner world becomes incredibly rich. The dream world, the spirit world, you know, their spiritual awareness can grow tremendously. A hospice friend of mine, a nurse, said, "Oh, I sometimes think I'm doing a spiritual or kind of arcology, you know, kind of digging up, you know, being there." And so this is so this seeing the practice of seeing the person as a whole person, and for Buddhists, is seeing the person as a Buddha, really seeing the person as a Buddha. As perfect, as complete, as whole, like ourselves. And that's important to add, like ourselves, yeah. Just like me, this person is whole, has capacity to love, to understand, to be cherished, has also fears and concerns and worries, yeah. So it's that's another important thing I've learned. The practice of seeing the person as a Buddha, and to also, and this is it really is so helpful, because there can be the underlying tendency to fix the person, to come in, especially when we feel fearful or feel very f vulnerable, and we get touched by it as well. You know, the first person I ever sat with, he was my age at the time. I started hospice work in Germany when I was in my mid-20s. So there was a young man my age with cancer, terminal, bald, fragile, weak from the chemo. And I sat with him, and I felt so helpless. And we were surrounded by by this clinical environment, whitewashed walls. And I think I never felt so helpless in my life as then. And at that time, and all he wanted was to live and get out of there, get the hell out of there. And I knew this won't happen, you know, this, and it didn't happen. So, and then to recognize, you know, not allowing the fear to prevent me to be there. Yeah. To recognize that there is fear, but I'm not my fear. So again, an awareness of that we can be bigger, that we are in fact bigger, and that the person is more than their illness, their diagnosis. And it might sound quite simple, but in practice it's quite hard. It's really quite hard, because when we feel touched, or when something is kind of resonates, when, you know, like the young man, I saw myself dying, you know, saw myself in the bed, or we are touched by somebody's loss when they're grieving, so to be aware of that, it's really that self-awareness which we train in meditation practice. It's very, very important to be bring the self-awareness to it, and to our practice of spirit, especially spiritual care. Because the spiritual care, what can happen is like, I have all the answers for you, but I don't. So it's a wish. I wish I have all the answers for you. For you, I wish I could take away your pain, but it's impossible. It's impossible. And there is this cliche, and it's actually really, really true, that the person we are with is our greatest teacher. I remember one gentleman, again back in the Sen Hospice. He was, I think he was in his mid-60s at the time. Charles was his name, and he was African American, and you know, I was this European middle class woman. I was at his bedside. He was one of my first patients in the Sen Hospice, and I sat with him, and he his whole body was emaciated by his disease. I think he had cancer. He was just skin and bones, just skin and bones. And so I just sat with him. It was a late afternoon. And I just sat with him. And I could feel also all of a sudden, kind of really tenderness, the tenderness and even tears welling up. And as a German, I was raised, my cultural upbringing is you don't show any emotions, you just, this is not okay. And so I try to, somehow to manage it. And he had his eyes closed, so I felt like I was safe. But then he opened his eyes and he looked at me straight. And this was really almost like as if I stood in a fierce fire. And I knew I couldn't pull back, I couldn't hide. I could not hide. So I knew, I learned in that moment, I had to stay. I really had to stay. I had to keep his eye contact, and not pull back with fear or any emotions, just to stay. And then I just said to him, Charles, I'm here. And then he just squeezed my hand. He just squeezed my hand, and he said, "Good, good, good." And then he closed his eyes and pulled his hand to his chest and put it there. And for the longest time, just held it there, just held it there. So it's the learning also from the people we are with, that they tell us what they need, that tell us how to be with them, or also how not to be with them. And it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to show our own humanness in that interaction. And to not to come in as a helper, as a fixer, as a spiritual caregiver, and it's also what I've learned. It's not the time to teach. I'm a meditation teacher. Of course, there is a tendency to teach or tell people. But I would have also learned it's not the time to teach. It's the time to show. And to really give loving kindness, to offer loving kindness. And it's not a teaching moment, it's not the time to share unless somebody asked my about my own practice. Yeah, so these are just my thoughts while when Vanessa approached me if I would share a little bit. That's about spiritual care. So for me, it's a practice of love. It's a practice of leaning into our own mortality and a practice of seeing the person as a Buddha. And with spiritual care, as a Tibetan Buddhist, is very much about taking the long-term view of the person, of not to see only their suffering, but the long-term view in terms of their spiritual development and progression of progress. So we're all on a path, and and to see, it's not just this life. We're looking at lifetimes. So, and to understand that the dying process itself and the moment of death, not only medical or biological processes, there's a profound spiritual process and moment. It's a sacred moment. And also after. And the more we can create a sacred environment, a calm, a peaceful environment, the more helpful it will be to the person. And I'm not talking about a nice decor, a nice room and with images and candles and what have you, or incense or whatever. I'm talking, sorry. What I'm referring to is here the room we have made within ourselves, the space we have made within ourselves to welcome the person. So the clearer I can be, the empty of myself or not be self-absorbed or self-conscious, just the more I can really be with a person because end of life care, being at the threshold of living and dying, is also it's the center is on the person who's dying. The center is The attention is on the person who's dying. And attention, giving that attention, is really a practice of love. One client of mine, he once said, "You know, Kirsten, I knew that I was loved because the way the other person, somebody in our team, the way she tied my shoes, I knew I was loved." Yeah, so that's a very moving example, how we do things, how we are, to bring that spiritual awareness into that, into that, meeting the other person, being with the other person. Yeah. And that also can be as that through touch, silence. But silence is not always what people want or need. For some people, silence is scary. It's threatening. They feel abandoned, you know? If I'm sitting there silently, they don't know what I'm doing. And they wonder, they really wonder. And so maybe there's also maybe the notion of spiritual care is also offering silent spaces, and that's beautiful and that's true. But sometimes we have to be attuned to really attune to that, be in tune with the other person to see, is this what is needed? Maybe the silence reminds the person of the punishment because his or her mom punished them with silence, the silent treatment, you know. I was with a really feisty lady. She was homeless and used to be homeless, and then she was in hosp on, hosp on a hospice ward, and she was one of the only times, you know, in her recent years that she had a room overhead and food and everything provided. But she just was rambunctious, feisty, angry, yelling at people. And so she just, you know, it was only a matter of time when, you know, when the chaplain came in, when he was kicked out. She didn't want to have that quiet, calm, stable, loving presence, this whole idea of concepts we might sometimes have. She wanted to have somebody who's real, who's alive, who's right there with her, can spar, be funny. So, and I, you know, I remember I was sitting with her, and I was sitting there quietly, and then she looked at me, "Are you dead yet?" You know. And I just laughed because I thought, oh yeah, you don't want to have a dead body, corpse, you know, a corpse in your room, you know. And then, you know, I realized she wanted to play. So some people, they need to be feel alive. They want to play. They watch. You know, sometimes spiritual care is watching a movie together and being with a person. Sometimes spiritual care is, you know, doing very, very ordinary things, you know. I can tell you when I first came to the States, I didn't know about all the afternoon shows, you know, whatever they're called now. They're probably still on, running for 100 years. But, you know, just sitting there side by side, watching a show, an afternoon show, the person having a smoke, but during that time, the person will tell you about their life. Yeah, this is the moment. It's safe. You're not looking at them. It's kind of light. It's not threatening. It's casual. At the same time, the person can relax. Maybe we have the experience when we sometimes sit in the car, you know, with somebody, and we have the most profound conversations because it's, you know, we are looking at the same direction and going into the same direction. So there is something to it, you know, that's that traveling together. Yeah. And yeah, so these are some of my thoughts about spiritual, the practice of spiritual care. And of course, as a Buddhist, for me, it's very much how my own practice informs me. So it's not so much in my practice of chaplaincy, Buddhist chaplaincy or Buddhist spiritual care. It's not so much about teaching meditation, teaching compassion practices. Is rather that these practices, they help me. They help me to stay present. They help me to stay compassionate. and to stay sane, you know, to really stay sane and to, yeah, to be there for the person. And though that has been my experience. Yes, sometimes people are interested, and sometimes I do share certain practices from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, for example, especially when people are really interested and really want to prepare themselves. And because it's, you know, it's the one notion my teacher was that don't allow them to die empty-handed. This is like there's something that they have that can draw on whatever source of inspiration it is. As Buddhists, we would call it refuge, but something that gives them a sense of belonging, something they know they can hold on to when everything is falling apart. So for some people, that could be a religious or spiritual practice, a prayer. For some people, that might be a poem or the legacy. You know, legacy work is very important also for chaplains at the threshold. You know, what am I leaving behind? Yeah, how do I want to be remembered? I had one beautiful elderly lady, and I just saw her here in our spiritual care center in Ireland, and she was home alone all through the pandemic. And then finally, when the first, you know, when we had the first lockdown ended, or a second, we were also open and could welcome guests again. And we were overrun by people because they were so isolated, so alone. I sat with her and she said, you know, you're the first person in a year I'm actually sitting with, you know, and then she was crying. And she just had received a terminal diagnosis of cancer. And she had grandkids and all. And she decided to write a letter to every single one. To really pass on what she had learned in her life. So legacy work is very important. And sometimes we can help people with that. I sat with people and maybe record them, or yeah, if they cannot write anymore, to write the letter, or just also receive. We can be the receiver of their wisdom, you know, to hear their voice and wisdom. And also hear the things that didn't go so well, to bear witness, to really bear witness to that. And that brings healing. It doesn't mean I have to do something or say something, but that itself brings tremendous healing, to bear witness to the regrets people have. And that's also a form of asking for forgiveness. That's from them, you know, that's for them to stay. If somebody can listen to me, if somebody can stay with me and doesn't recoil and can bear it with me, can bear that burden, then it's okay. Yeah, so these are just my thoughts about practice of spiritual care and end of life care at the threshold of life and death. And looking at the time, I also want to make sure to hear from you. Maybe you came today because something is happening in your own life. You have a situation maybe at home with a parent, a friend, a family member, or just an observation or question. So I would like to open it up if you can. And I think as if you I don't know, raise your hand, and I think maybe then, Vanessa, you can unmute people. Yeah.
Sure, yeah, you could try your
Yeah,
Zoom hand
good.
or your human hand either way.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim.
Hey, hi. Kirsten, I'm curious how you deal with time management. So, I'm in a hospital and don't usually have so much time with each patient. So things like sitting with someone in silence or watching a TV show, are not necessarily things you'd be able to do in a hospital setting so easily. So I'm just
Yeah.
curious how you kind of best use your time. Say if you have X number of people to see in a day. Like, do you kind of determine it based on their need, Or do you try and divide time equally? Like, how do you approach that?
You honestly, I do it intuitively, you know. If I really think about this, it's a more intuition, and I know the realities of it. We have to see so many people in the day, you know. That's a reality. I do have the luxury here in our spiritual care center. We only have a maximum of 7 people, you know. So that's a luxury, a true luxury. But what I find helpful to see, it's not the length of time. It's how am I present with a person? You know, if I really offer my full presence as much as possible, and really also come with this as a spirit of loving kindness, or kind of really that empathy, people feel that, and they don't remember how long I was with them. They remember the feeling, you know, that's what I hear. They remember, and we know it, you may know it yourself, that, oh, that person was really fully present with me in that moment, you know, and I felt seen and understood. Maybe that was only 2 minutes or 5 minutes. There has been some research done of residents in training, and some residents were asked to talk to their patients standing at the bedside. And others were asked to sit down next to the bedside on a chair. And then they asked the patients what their experience was. And uniformly, they said that they have felt like when the doctor was sitting down, they spent more time with them. But it wasn't the case, you know. So it's really that the quality, you know, and the attention, really the full attention. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, Jim, does it is that helpful? Yeah, or
Yeah, that's nice. It's, yeah, I mean, even the thing with sitting down, I've always resisted that because, sometimes it's hard in a hospital to find a spot to sit down, but I've really tried to get in the habit of doing that. And as you say, it's an amazing difference. Like, people will open up so much more readily when you're sat down. But sometimes I'll even just squat down if there's no chair. And it's just amazing what difference that makes. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's about the quality, the presence rather than the time spent. Thank you.
And also the eye contact, because that's all very to have the eye contact, eye level, you know, eye level, not looking down. Because we have to remember the hand that gives is always higher, you know, there is this power gap. So it's like to really, just to know. Sometimes when I know, you know, when we have many guests, for example, and I know, well, I have to see quite a number, and you know, some people need more than others. I said, well, I do have 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, and I'm here, you know. So I say it up front so they know. That's also something very simple but helpful. And I try to come back later, but then I have to, you know, when I promise to come back later, I come back later, you know. Yeah. Thank you. I see Bernadette on my screen. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you for being here. I had the privilege of going to visit Oganbera years ago, and it's a very beautiful place. It's a very beautiful place you're in. I'm caught by the language you used of it's not about the beautiful place or the room. You talked about meeting in the car or, all the different potential meeting places in the universe where we can meet. The language that really I'd like you to say a little bit more about, and I think Jim's question touched on this, as you said, it's not about the beautiful room. It's the room I make of myself. Those were your words, and they touch me very deeply because I oftentimes feel that I am rushed, and the reality of other people coming into the room who have to deal with the business of social work, or this happened yesterday with a homeless person who he was very agitated and waiting for a social worker, and yet he and I met and connected and walked together for actually quite a while. It was a beautiful kind of meeting. And then the social worker came in, and boom, in a second, it was over with. So it's holding that within myself that I walked as far as I could with him, and then I had to let go. And so that gave me language. You're calling it a room of my own, curing that room and inviting or allowing another person to join me, or vice versa. Entering in that language is very helpful to me.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you, Bennett. But how beautiful that you both had that walking alongside together, and he had that moment, you know. And yes, things happen, you know, they always do. And they're natural endings and sometimes abrupt endings. But to really, how beautiful that is, you know, and maybe that was enough. And sometimes, you know, that's enough. So the room I make within myself, I have like more the feeling like when I sit with people, walk with them or whatever I do, that's kind of a space within myself opens up, and to relax into that, you know, it's is because being present is also relaxing in the bigger presence we both, you know, the person and I, are held by, you know, and what we can refer to as spirituality or spiritual awareness, you know, we are both held by it. So yeah, to trust that as well. And I can tell you a secret. Sometimes what I do when I know I need to have that more quiet time with a person, I'm not sure if that's happening, but I have a deep felt sense or intuition that's what's needed. And I sometimes even imagine or visualize a protective tent or dome, you know. Maybe those of you who are Tibetan Buddhists, you know the practice, but it's like you really kind of for that moment you really visualize this as protective, a protective sphere you're in, you know, a field, you know, an environment for the person to be safe. And you can even leave it around them, visualize it, and when you leave, it's still around them, holding them.
Well, thank you for that. In this case, this individual that I'm speaking of was a homeless person who, looking in his eyes, he has been used to most of his life living on the street and being very suspicious of people walking around the corner. And I could see it in his eyes. So it was very important to just make that space that I could be safe for him. It was a real privilege. Meet him there
So
in that
safety.
room. Safety, yes. So thank you. Thank you for your
Thank
words.
you. Thank you, Ben. I say Kristen, Christy.
Yes, close to your name, not quite. So I'm not part of the chaplaincy program, but I'm working a little bit with Vanessa. My husband was recently diagnosed with ALS, and the question I have for you right now is he's beginning to talk about and consider if and when he might want to take advantage of physician-assisted dying. Can you say something about how I could best accompany in that process?
If you're okay, can I ask you a question? How, when he asked that, how are you with that?
I'm comfortable with that if that's what he wants, because ALS is a horrible way to die. And I'd rather, if he wants to do that, I'd rather accompany him in that process than suffer more. So.
Have you told him that? So, that's very reassuring then that you're both, together. and this decision, you know, that you can be fully there. There's no struggle, because sometimes there can be struggle. You know, don't leave me. Why are you doing this? And you can hear it's all about the person who was left behind, you know. But this letting go process is, yeah, we all have to do it. And if a person is a, their sincere decision, and you can support it, if you can, then yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
We had a visit from our, we are members of a Unitarian Universalist church. We had a visit from our minister this week, and he asked her about this. And one of her pieces of advice was to, you know, make sure he spoke with this about his, with his children, and that he was clear to, you know, clear out regrets, and she didn't say the word forgiveness, but I think practice of forgiving and that kind of stuff. So that would be true regardless of whether he made this choice or not. But
And he may not make this choice, you know, at least to talk about it openly, can relieve a lot of fears. Because people want to be, we all want to be in control, you know, we want to be in control, be our own agent in our lives. And this is what death takes away from us. And this, that's a process of letting go, a process of the deepest possible surrender. And I personally, I struggle with that because I've seen people who are, you know, with, you know, an illness and a diagnosis. I was just, and initially they thought they couldn't bear it, the, you know, when they knew what was ahead of them. Because what our mind does, we jump to the worst possible scenario. But it's not happening now. But the fear is like the fears can take over. So I always would check, is your decision based on fear? Yeah. How can we alleviate that fear, you know, medically, with, you know, and also by also spiritually, emotionally, you know, or feeling, oh, I'm a burden to the family, I'm letting them down, the fear of pain, you know, of the dying process, and just to really educate people, this is how it will be or could be, but we're never sure. But this is your, with your prognosis, this is to be expected, and to really be really clear about this. But if the per and of course, as a Buddhist, as for me personally, it's very hard, you know, because I do believe to the last moment, life is precious. So if I ended prematurely from that perspective. I still have to deal with what with my karma. It doesn't go away, you know. But it's easy for me to say if I'm not in their shoes, you know, I don't have the pain. I'm not locked into my body, you know. And so maybe, you know, I change my mind as well, you know, and quiver in my boots when it's my time, you know. And but to really see that that wish of for autonomy can be a tremendous burden and can cause so much pain, you know. Because I also have seen, like with this Japanese lady, you know, all of a sudden she had people rush in to take care of her and she was so independent. But that surrender and letting other people take care of you know, and those of us who are, who like to do that, how much it gives us, you know. So it's a really privilege and honor as well. And there is a, I've seen, and I really mean it, really do mean it. I've seen people really grow at the end of their lives tremendously, and become a yeah, just almost like a new person. Not everybody, but some people really. They shine. They really shine. So I wouldn't like to take this away, but also I'd never know what the internal experience of somebody is. Maybe the external experience is really of, you know, during the moment of death and before. Just getting out of this body is physically a really hard process. And, people shake and shiver, could be, not always, but to know this is part of that physical dying process, but there's still a spirit that's whole in there, Chrissy, thank you for bringing that up. So it's not an easy thing. There's so quite so so there's so many layers to it. So the clearer, so, yeah, to be clear every step of the way, and to to
Thank you
offer you,
very much.
thank you. I see Barbara.
Yeah, good morning or good afternoon. So I've been crying in the last few moments, few minutes, and this is my first time here. And I'm not a chaplain, and I'm with a dear friend who I am the power of attorney for, and I've known him 25 years, and just a long history. So walking with him right now, and he's 89; he'll be 90 next month, and he has some dementia that's increased. He has some blood in his urine, and we're kind of waiting for this diagnosis. And so he's more confused. And I know that there's a lot of fear around death, my own fear too. So lots of fear in the field, lots of fear. So just hearing you talk this morning, lots of, words of wisdom. Anyway, any thoughts you have, or I'm just wanting, I would like to be present with him as much as possible. And I know my own tears are coming too, because it's my own attachment to him. So letting him go, and then also being able to, I liked, I mean, different things that you said, but just it's not about me, it's about him. So, and I'm aware of that, and how to walk that path. Anyway, any thoughts? Thank you.
That's a bit of a koan, no? It's about the other person at the same time. We have that relationship. And and there's this deep wish, or a wish for you to be free, and we do feel the grief, Grief doesn't begin with the moment of death. Grief starts long before, you're grieving. That's what grief that is. Could you tell him
What
how
did
you with that?
you just say about freedom? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Grief,
The wish.
grief,
Sorry.
that grief that sometimes grief starts, when somebody has died after death, and the bereavement process. But grief starts way early, anticipatory grief, already grieving he won't be there in my life anymore, grieving the loss of relationship now, so it's actually you're grieving now,
Or the
so
change. Our relationship has changed. Sorry to interrupt. It's the role change. So he actually took care of me. And then we've switched. And now I'm take care of him. And even when we drive now, he'll look at me and go, and he's a big man. And he will say, oh, I used to take care of you. And now you're taking care of me. And there's this little smile. So he has this recognition, those roles have switched. So it's very, kind and t it's more it's sweet and poignant, and so yes, and that's where we're, those roles have switched. Anyway, please,
So
sorry, I
if you have
interrupted.
that really, it sounds like, Barbara, you have this really close, beautiful relationship with him. So you can just let him know, this is how it is for me, This is how it is for me. You're not there in a professional capacity. You're there as a good friend. And so this is how it is for me. And it's hard, and I can only imagine how hard it is for you. And but there's love, and because underneath the fear is love, the current of love. So once we kind of, again, naming it, really naming it,
And we
and
do that.
with its
Yeah, there's a,
power.
but being maybe even naming it, being clearer, or naming it more, or yeah, looking to his eyes. And sometimes I feel like
sometimes,
I'm busy with him and I need to just be present with him.
yeah.
Sorry,
And
go
to
ahead.
grieve together, to really also to grieve together. Yeah.
But he's afraid. He's very afraid. And he's in denial, I think. There's a denial. And I was in denial. I
Yeah.
probably still am. But that's, you know,
Yeah.
so helping him with that, his own fears.
You know, when you share with him how you are, your feelings, it
Yes.
might help him to find his own words and connect to what's happening for him. Maybe
Okay.
not come in with that, but it might help him, you know,
Yes.
if you're really honest and authentic and genuine, like, wow, this is really hard, you know.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And Randall? Yeah.
Thank you so much for your sincerity and generosity. I know time is ebbing here, but I would hope that at some point, if you come back again, that you could talk more about at the threshold of life, the beginning of life. So many of the people that I'm seeing in the children's hospital are dealing with the mother and infant issues that come up that are very sincere, some very, very difficult and anguishing in certain cases. And I would love to hear you talk more about that.
Yeah. Thank you, Randall. Yeah. This is such a vast field, you know, and because death doesn't only happen at the end of life, it also happens at the beginning of life, you know. Actually, in thinking today of what I like to share, the story of Krishna Gotami came to mind. You know, the story of Krishna Gotami, who lost her baby and went to the Buddha with her dead baby in her arms, say, could you help me? Can you revive the baby? I don't know the gender, but, you know, can you revive him or her? And he said, yeah, just find a mustard seed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the mustard seed in your village from a house where they haven't known death. So, of course, she's elated. There's something she can do. And of the story, you might imagine, you couldn't find a single family in her village that hadn't been touched by death. You know? So she comes back to the Buddha and tells him, yeah, I realize that's not a unique experience. Yeah. So I'm not alone in this. And she starts to follow him. And because I was sat with a young woman just a few weeks ago who just had lost her baby in childbirth, completely unexpected. They had no explanations. They did an autopsy that still don't know why. And she was told these can happen. Yeah. We don't know. We don't know. And just to sit with her and to listen to her story, just to receive that story fully, and allow her, to come to terms with it, because, you know, she's also grieving the future, you know, that won't be happening. Yeah. So, yeah, but this is a huge, huge topic. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Randall. Yeah, I brought a little video from Sokshambhara, the meditation center, but there won't be time now to share it.
Perhaps we can share the link and then folks.
Oh, you can share.
Look.
We can share the link. That's actually to the Spiritual Care Center. Yeah, that would be lovely if we can share the link. Yeah, get a sense of it. Yeah. Good. So, Marilyn, you had your hand up.
Yeah, and maybe it's too late. This has been wonderful. I really appreciate what you're saying. So I don't know, should we save this question for this next round? Yes. Okay, let's do that. I'll take my hand.
Okay.
Sorry, one second.
So you shared the link in the chat.
I shared the link.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you, Kirsten. We're at time, but thank you so much for coming today and sharing with so much heart and so much warmth about your experiences, your thoughts about chaplaincy and your practice of chaplaincy, and your practice of just of being and presence at the end of life. Thank you. Very inspiring. And
Thank
thank you
you.
to all who've joined. Thank you. I'm happy to see some faces of folks who are coming to join us now every month for this series. It's wonderful to see. This series, we do very much appreciate any donations that come in. I'm just going to put the link in the chat there. There's the link to the donations page. Thank you. And then just to let you know, the next talk will be on the 16th of March with Nathan Jishin Michon. We'll be talking about chaplaincy work in the context of crisis and disaster. So I think this will be a wonderful talk. And also just something to put in your calendars. If anybody here is interested at all in the Saati Center's Buddhist chaplaincy training program, there will be an information session on April the 13th in the morning. We have not yet posted that date on the website, so you're the first to hear about it. But it'll be on the 13th of April. We're going to have an online information session for anybody who's curious, or if you know anybody who is curious. We have now two programs. We have an online and an in-person program. So for folks living close to the Bay Area or within commuting distance of the Bay Area, there's an in-person program, and then there's an online program for folks who are remote. So just bear that in mind. Lovely. Okay, so we'll say goodbye to everybody, and I'll ask the current chaplaincy students to stay on the line. Okay, thank you so much, everybody. Have a wonderful day.